You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Last Friday, Dr. Abdel Karim al-Irani, political advisor to the president of Yemen, briefed Arab journalists on the question of cooperation with the U.S. in the so-called war on terrorism. This in the shadow of a buildup of a war against Iraq and rhetoric of getting Saddam Hussein. Reem Kathuda, WPFW's correspondent for Pacifica's Peace Watch, attended the briefing and filed this report.
Dr. Abdel Karim al-Aryani, the former prime minister of Yemen, is now the political advisor to the Yemeni president. Dr. al-Aryani came to Washington, D.C. last week to help address the Yemen position about the war against Iraq and the U.S. missile strike on Yemen. This strike, triumphantly announced by the USA on Election Day, had killed six people 2 days prior, on Sunday, November 3rd. It was criticized as an extrajudicial killing in violation of international human rights laws by Amnesty International, the international human rights advocacy group based in the UK. Friday, after breaking fast at an iftar hosted by Mr. Abdul Wahab al-Hajri, Yemen's ambassador to the USA, Dr. al-Aryani addressed 40 or so Arab journalists worried about this precedent and the continued U.S. support for what the reporters called Israel's execution of Palestinians. Dr. al-Aryani framed the issue around the talk of the day, terrorism.
Today, even in cartoons showing the criminals, is a bearded man. It has an implication for all of us. And American and public media. Three countries were mentioned. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen. Three countries that may be targeted after the event. Of course, Yemeni leadership became aware of the danger. I had the honor to be instructed to come and talk to all officials with the help of the ambassador. And we were able to at least delay any action. Then, thank goodness, the ambassador was successful to get a presidential visit. And we agreed, and there was no secret about it, that we will cooperate in confronting terrorism. But for Yemen, we will never, ever cooperate in a war against Iraq. This is out of the question, and our friends in the United States know it. The officials have said it many times. We think there could be peaceful solution to a problem. We are not saying it's not a problem. But there is a problem. But for Yemen to cooperate in a war against Iraq is impossible.
I asked Dr. al-Aryani about the general sense of the Arab region about the build-up for a war against Iraq.
Worry and concern. The Middle East today is in the greatest turmoil in the 21st century. We have been through turmoils the first decade of the 20th. But I am afraid that the 21st century may be worse. The most dangerous thing about it, that hope is very, very small. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers who started the 20th century had in their hands greater hope than us who are starting the 21st. At that time, Arab nationalism, Arab unity, Arab struggle, the movements in Syria, in Egypt, the great fighters either against the Ottomans, then against the French and the British, and it was turmoil with hope. Unfortunately, we have a turmoil with very little hope. Arab countries today are in the greatest state of disintegration politically.
What was the Yemeni reaction to Syria's voting yes on the UN resolution to enforce inspection on Iraq?
This is up to Syria. That's their own policy and their own decision. They decided to vote that way. They must have considered it in their interest. The Arab League does not commit individual countries how they conduct their policies. But there was no resolution to vote no. The Arab League agreed that Iraq must abide by Security Council resolutions. And I'm sure the Syrians voted yes from this also principle.
You know a lot about the region and the world, and you've been in Baghdad recently, and you've also been all over the world. What is your sense of the vulnerability of such a resolution to the safety of the region?
The safety of the region was under question mark before this resolution. Perhaps this resolution gave a very tight window of opportunity to avoid war. And I think the inspectors have been saying this, that there is an opportunity to avoid war. And if there is that opportunity, I do pray and hope that our brothers in Iraq will never leave stone unturned in order to give this opportunity a chance. The only way for the Iraqis, in my view, is to deal with the United Nations, not to deal with American decisions. It's a good sign that the Americans have had to come back to the United Nations, and I think Iraq should make use of this. And every Arab country prays that Iraq will give this window of opportunity its chance.
The anti-war movement in the United States is very concerned about the no-fly zone imposed by USA and Britain.
Unfortunately, certain signals had come out at the level of Mr. Rumsfeld. But finally, the Secretary General of the United Nations has been very clear and honest in saying that this business of no-fly zone, the act by Iraq to confront the military aircrafts over the no-fly zone, is no violation of Resolution 1441. And I think the Secretary General was wise. So the concern remains there, but at least an international personality at the stature of Mr. Kofi Annan has said to the United States and to Great Britain, whatever happens in these no-fly zones has nothing to do with Resolution 1441.
I checked with Mohammed El-Maitami, professor at Sana'a University, whether the claim that Yemen would not support a war against Iraq would hold, given Yemen's cooperation with the USA.
It is very, very difficult, even impossible, for any Yemen official to announce his agreement with Americans to strike Iraq.
What would happen in Yemen if they were to do that?
They will get a lot of trouble. Any Yemeni official will cross over the red line supporting Americans in striking Iraq will get a lot of problem.
The Yemeni people are armed.
Yeah, we have 60 million pieces of arms in Yemen. That's a lot. The people themselves, even if they're not armed, they will not. Any government needs support their people. If any government will cross this red line, will not have the support. It means they will not have al-Sharia, what you call it, legitimacy.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
Last Saturday, the Philadelphia Regional Anti-War Network, a coalition of peace groups in southeast Pennsylvania, organized a demonstration against the upcoming conflict in Iraq. There were over two dozen speakers from such groups as Veterans for Peace, House of Grace Catholic Worker, and Campaign to End the Sanctions. About 3,000 protesters marched from Philadelphia City Hall to the Liberty Bell and back again. Jamie Graham was there and files this report.
On Saturday, November 23rd, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, about 3,000 people gathered at City Hall to demonstrate against the upcoming war in Iraq. The protest had been organized by the Philadelphia Regional Anti-War Network, a coalition including 20 peace groups.
Freedom marchers starting from West and North Philadelphia arrived at the downtown rally a little past noon, just as the speakers began the opening remarks.
David Klein, president of Veterans for Peace, emphasized the lingering effects of the previous Gulf War on veterans.
Gulf War veterans, you know, they told us after the Gulf War in 1991, oh, we didn't get any casualties, we only lost about 300 people. 11 years later, of the 500,000 soldiers who were sent to the Gulf, 30% of them are considered disabled by the Veterans Administration right now. A phenomenal figure, a 30% wound rate. 10,000 are dead. So let's talk about the real casualties of war, the continuing casualties of war. I'm just talking about the American side. I'm not even talking about the situation among the Iraqi people.
Joanna Berrigan from Philadelphia's Catholic Worker House.
The Bush administration would like to lead us to believe that this is a war to take out Saddam. If we go to war, it doesn't take out Saddam, it takes out innocent civilians. And it's been taking out innocent civilians. 500,000 children under the age of five have died as a result of our policy in that country.
She also commented on the suffering and devastation in Iraq caused by the last war and economic sanctions that she witnessed during a recent visit to the area.
Different focuses brought different protesters out. Mustafa Asadi, a U.S. citizen from Iran.
In Washington, snipers who were destroyed people's life. Now what U.S. doing in Iraq is exactly the snipers shooting every day. People don't know when and what time that bomb's going to come on their house or killing them. I'm absolutely against this brutal government who's killing people and working just for oil companies.
Frank Walsh, resident of West Philadelphia.
Demonstrations that really don't affect the system per se. What they do is form a sense of community, give us a feeling of solidarity, first with the marchers and also with the public in general that observes or witnesses the spectacle of a march.
The march is going to head along City Hall.
Around 1 o'clock, the rally marched down Market Street toward the Liberty Bell.
One of the more entertaining groups was a street theater troupe wearing thrift store fineries who called themselves the Party for Permawar to mock the Bush administration.
We want oil! We want gas! Watch out, world will kick your...
Once the crowd reached the Liberty Bell, an array of activists spoke from a sound truck, such as Pedro Rodriguez, the executive director of Action Alliance of Senior Citizens of Greater Philadelphia.
Don't be sidetracked on attacking soldiers. Don't be sidetracked on attacking the media. Don't be sidetracked on petty arguments. Your responsibility, your job, is to speak to your neighbors, to your fellow students, to your senior citizens, to your relatives, to your co-workers, to your children, to your family relatives, and say, you have to speak up for peace now, because this war is unjust.
With unyielding spirits, the brigade of peaceful protesters made a circuit back to City Hall for the rally's closing speeches.
The only police presence throughout the protest was plainclothes officers of the Philadelphia Civil Affairs Unit. There was little confrontation, no arrest made,
and even a bit of humor.
Cops against the war! Civil affairs are cops against the war!
When the protest concluded, Kitty Bryant, an organizer with Campaign to End the Sanctions, reflected upon past and the future of anti-war action.
For me, it really represents an opportunity to come out and say to so many more people, you know, look at what has happened. Look what the United States has done, and in the Middle East, and not just towards Iraq, but towards this whole militarization, this whole mission of taking over the world, essentially, that now they're fairly open about. But they've been doing it now regularly and using Iraq, really using the situation in Iraq to their advantage. And most people in the United States really have so little idea of what's going on. So it's a big opportunity to be out, talk to people, create a sense of solidarity that what's happened in Iraq is wrong. We should try to stop right now anything else happening. But it's a longer-term perspective of living in the world, that we should try to live in the world, really think of ourselves as people of the world. So that's what I'm here for.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Jamie Graham
and Dante Tozzo.
At the New School University in New York City, a number of students walked out of class in protest of the pro-war position of its president, former Democratic Senator Bob Kerry. Kerry not only has taken a pro-war stance, but is a member of an ultra-conservative group actually advocating for the freedom of Iraq. The New School, founded by radical pacifists and war resistors at the end of World War I, were obviously outraged and have filed petitions calling for Kerry's resignation. We sat down with student organizer Colin Walsh.
A week prior to that, we had called President Kerry's office, the President Bob Kerry, the former senator and president of the New School, and requested an appointment just for a couple of unaffiliated students to talk with him to discuss his very public pro-war stance. They didn't respond to that. They returned my call on Friday to say that they would get back to me, and then they never called me again. So on Wednesday the 20th, feeling quite snubbed, 25 students decided that there was one way to take the next step, and that was to walk into his office. Well, 25 students, not all of who even necessarily knew each other beforehand, met just off of campus and at 2 o'clock, and we quickly came to a consensus of a plan of what to do, and we went over to the New School, and we walked into Bob Kerry's office and sat down. And then in unison, we said, because of your politics and the war on the war in Iraq, we demand that you hold a public forum. Now, unfortunately, President Kerry declined to schedule the event immediately.
So you sat there, and what was his response?
Well, his immediate response was, I agree. However, he's agreed to forums in the past and then not quite managed to schedule them. So we insisted that we have a date and a time. And he just animately objected to that and really became very, very hostile to the students.
What does that mean?
He was pacing back and forth in the office and swearing under his breath. You know, calling us, you know, some things I don't really want to say on the radio. And then he did engage us in dialogue on the war, and which is the main purpose of why we're there. Although, you know, we feel that his stance is having a tremendous impact on the New School community. It's very disheartening to the students.
What is his stance, and how is it disheartening the student population?
It's this. He is an not just in favor of going to war in Iraq. He is putting himself in the position of being a public advocate for going to war in Iraq. He's the member of a committee called the Committee to Liberate Iraq. And he serves on this committee with George Shultz and John McCain, Randy Schuneman, who is a veteran Republican Senate foreign policy staffer, who recently worked for Donald Rumsfeld on Iraq policy, Bruce P. Jackson, who's a vice president of arms maker Lockheed Martin, and the committee is advised by Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice. This is an outrageous thing to me that the president of our, you know, supposedly radical left-leaning school is affiliating with these hardline right-wingers. Mm. And the purpose of this committee is specifically to affect public opinion on the war in Iraq.
So how did former Senator Kerry get to this position, get to have this position as president of this liberal radical school with these type of politics around this war?
I don't think that this was thought of as a main issue when they were appointing him.
Is this an issue? Is this of concern to the Board of Trustees at this point?
I would hope so. I would hope so. But I haven't spoken to the trustees yet. They'll be meeting in early December, at which time I do hope to have some conversations with trustees around this.
So he's on this committee, and he has agreed to meet with you all when?
Well, he's holding a public forum on December 4th at 1 o'clock in the Tishman Auditorium, which is in the 12th Street building. It's the largest venue on campus. And it's actually a fantastic victory for the students that he agreed to do this, because first, he's now willing to engage in dialogue with his students. He seems to have a certain amount of contempt for the students at the school. He was interviewed recently on the local NPR station and said that students are somewhat concerned about the war. I mean, I'm paraphrasing now. Students are somewhat concerned about the war, but really they're much more concerned about getting jobs and their future. And what I think, and I think what a lot of students think, is that our future is inherently tied to the foreign policies of our country, and that includes going to war with Iraq.
How would you characterize the mood or the attitude of the majority of the student population there? Would you say that many are against the war?
Oh, yeah, I would say 9-1. Against the war across the divisions.
How large is this school?
There are about 15,000 students at the school.
What do you anticipate will happen on December 4th when Kerry conducts or holds or entertains or hosts this forum?
Well, I think that it will be a learning experience for both the president and the students. I think that dialogue of this nature is really important to gain understanding. I think he will come to understand the points of view and opinions of students at the school better than he does now, and their commitment to peace. And I think that students will come to understand his position better. And honestly, I think that students will probably be more outraged, the more educated they become mm-hmm. about the issue.
Any chance the students are going to have demands that might include having him resign from this committee, or as long as he's the president of this school?
Well, the committee who's organizing the event are not going to make demands from the stage in any way. We don't see that as our role. We want to foster dialogue. Mm-hmm. But from talking to students in the community at large, I sense a very strong and growing desire for him to resign.
Any physical evidence of that? Or, I mean, are there signs posted, or are there rallies being held? Or?
There are signs being posted on campus. I haven't seen any signs yet that specifically call for his resignation.
Student Colin Walsh. Historically, the new school's purpose is to build a community where people can work and live together for world peace. The U.S. was in an uproar last week over Canadian Director of Communications Francois Ducrot's statement that American President George W. Bush is a moron. But according to Toronto-based film director Albert Nirenberg, a self-proclaimed stupidity expert, that description might not be so far-fetched after all.
About a year and a half ago, we started a documentary on the history of stupidity. And at the time, we were approached by a television broadcaster to do a documentary on something else, and I just felt this was an important issue. And we have been doing it for a while, and we discovered that no one has made a movie essentially about stupidity, and there are only 7 books of academic study of stupidity, and most of them are anecdotal. They're just like, you know, stories about people falling down the stairs or mm-hmm. setting themselves on fire. There's no theories as to why human beings are so stupid.
Mm.
So we felt it was very important. There is another guy who is a self-proclaimed stupidity expert. Mm. His name is James Wells. He lives in Florida, and he was arrested recently and put in jail. Yeah, and for something very stupid. So that left only us. And we are really, I mean, there probably are others, but there are very few experts on stupidity, and I don't claim to be the world's best.
Well, how'd you get so smart?
Well, I'm not. In fact, one of my experiences with stupidity is that when I was a child, I was put in remedial English because they thought I was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also put back a grade. And then I skipped 2 grades. So they were. People have always been confused about my level of intelligence.
Well, now who's calling our president a moron, and why?
The story emanates from Prague. Basically, what was happening was that the president, George W. Bush, was essentially trying to rally the new NATO countries into an aggressive attack on Iraq. And I think during that speech, the director of communications for the Canadian Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, was overheard telling a reporter, her exact words were, "What a moron." And so that quote was then made it into Canadian papers, and then it made it to the Canadian Parliament, and then it's being picked up. And in fact, I think you guys are quite early on this, in that it's hitting America probably tonight on Crossfire. And probably will be all over the American papers, though it already is in some American papers.
Mm-hmm. And so this high-ranking federal Canadian official, was that Francois Ducrot?
You've got it, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what has she said since then with regard to this comment about calling President W. Bush a moron?
She's apologized, and she's offered to resign. And the prime minister refused to accept her resignation, and then had a press conference where he said, "The president, George W. Bush, is not a moron. He's a friend of mine." Now, every school child, this to me was unbelievable. This proves that actually our prime minister, Canada's prime minister, is probably a bigger moron than the American president, because every school child knows that if you want to insult somebody, you just say they're not stupid. You know, he's not an idiot. If you say that in that way, people are going, "Oh, really? Well, then maybe he is an idiot."
Mm.
Why does that prove that he's not a moron? Just because he's your friend and you're pretty dumb. So, yeah, that was quite outrageous, and I think that looks bad on the Canadian Prime Minister.
Well, now, what would make anyone say or even think that the president of the superpower nation, the United States, could be a moron?
There are several books about George Bush's intelligence. One that's more recent is called the Bush Dyslexicon, and there's another one called Bushisms. And Bushisms focuses on the fact that George Bush has problems speaking English, and he actually is dyslexic, apparently. But the Dyslexicon more or less focuses on the fact that he has never been interested in education, was proud of the fact that he was a C student.
Yeah, but he graduated from an Ivy League college.
Yes, that's true. And he is not an idiot.
That proves he's no moron.
Well, a moron's an interesting thing, because what a moron is somebody who, according to the original terms, has an IQ of between 50 and 75. But the word was invented by a guy named Henry Goddard, who was a psychologist in New Jersey, who believed that there are some people that were actually, let's say, stupid or mentally retarded, but that you couldn't tell. They seemed perfectly normal, they were quite sociable and friendly, and they got along well with people, but yet they were mentally retarded or they were stupid. So he invented the word moron to apply to those people, because moron originally was applied to immigrants that were coming across in Ellis Island in New York City. And hundreds of thousands of people were deported from the United States because they were thought to be morons. And at the time, he developed a theory that morons' breeding creates more morons. If you're a moron, you marry a moron, you're going to have moron kids. And so for that, they even had a policy of sterilizing mentally retarded people based on that theory. So it's quite shocking stuff. And mm-hmm. Okay, but is George Bush a moron? It's interesting to think about it. He looks like a president, he acts like a president, but he says very dumb things. That is moronic. He may not be a moron, but he's moronic.
For example, what kind of very dumb things?
I have a whole book. He says, "I believe what I believe and I know what I know."
Is that a direct quote from President
yeah.
Bush?
But I recommend that you look up Bushisms or the Bush Dyslexicon. There are entire books about the funny things that George Bush has said.
Albert Nirenberg is the executive producer of Trailer Vision. His documentary entitled Stupidity will air on Canadian television this spring. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Josh Chaffin, Tom Gomez, and Marcus Tyler Brown. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at PacificaArchives.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.